Minnesota top stories, an informed security source says there will not be any negotiations between Iran and the U.S. until Washington lifts all its unilateral sanctions. Two top New York Democrats, including state Senate Majority Leader, urged Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign over sexual harassment allegations. Thousands of people march in Haiti to demand an end to the incumbent president's tenure amid a political turmoil in the country. Welcome to the World News. An informed security source says Iran has no plan to hold talks with the United States until Washington lifts all sanctions it unilaterally imposed on Tehran. A source said the highest level in Iran's chain of command has rejected any gradual negotiations unless Washington corrects its past mistakes. A source added that the West has misinterpreted the latest remarks by Iran's president and foreign minister. That is after the top Iranian diplomat said his country would be ready to take compensatory measures after the removal of U.S. restrictions. President Hassan Rouhani also said the 2015 nuclear deal will be reactivated once the U.S. removes sanctions. He said Iran is the only party that has paid for keeping the deal alive so far. Political commentator Tohid Asadi says Iran's refusal to enter into talks with the U.S. has its origins in its years-long experience of fruitless talks with Washington.
When he came to the office, there was this belief that he's going to take a different approach. He's going to be a different person than the previous administration and Trump. But the thing is that, practically speaking, what has been observed so far is a repetition of the same trajectory that Iran observed 4 or 5 years after JCPOA was signed and sealed. Iran has got this failed experience of going through the trajectory of negotiations with Washington for past maybe 40 years. And this by itself could add to lack of trust that exists not only among Iranian, nation, but also among Iranian elites from different parties. And there is now this consensus that the United States is not a country to be trusted in any kind of negotiation. That's why we hear such statements from Iranian officials.
The Yemeni army says it has launched 14 loaded drones and 8 ballistic missiles targeting major Saudi military and oil facilities inside the kingdom. Saudi Energy Ministry confirmed that a drone hit a petroleum tank at Ras Tanura port, which is one of the world's largest oil shipping ports. Ministry added that a ballistic missile also targeted Saudi Aramco facility in the city of Dhahran. Earlier, the Yemeni army said the drone and missile attacks targeted major Saudi military and oil facilities deep inside the kingdom. Army spokesman Yahya Sari' said the attacks hit Aramco facilities and military sites in Asir province and the cities of Dammam and Jazan. Sari' also noted that the Yemeni army shot down a Saudi reconnaissance plane over Yemen's Jowf province. Our Sana'a correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali says the drone and ballistic missile attacks on various Saudi targets are one of the biggest strikes carried out against the kingdom.
I believe this is the first biggest operation until the moment held by the or carried out by the Yemeni army. 14 drones along with 8 ballistic missiles were launched simultaneously, targeting several targets at the depth of the Saudi Arabia and Dammam, Jizan, Asir military camps were targeted, oil facilities were targeted. This is a proof that the Yemeni army has now bigger capabilities to respond to the Saudi aggression. The oil facilities are now the major target for the Yemeni army due to the fuel crisis in Yemen. We have a harsh shortage of fuel. The Saudi led coalition did not allow even a liter of petrol or diesel to enter the country since the beginning of 2021. So the Yemeni army will continue carrying out these operations. The Aramco facilities will be the major target for the Yemeni army to put more pressure on the Saudi regime to release the 14 detained oil vessels and end the suffering of the Yemeni people regarding fuel and the fuel crisis.
Yemen's medical workers staged a demonstration in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. They slammed the continued seizure of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition, which has led to the closure of many medical facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washadi has more in this report.
Hundreds of medical workers have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get one because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers.
Blocking oil vessels from entering the country threatens to stop many health facilities. There are more than 1,500 health centers and 400 laboratories and blood banks on the verge of closure. Centers that generate oxygen may also stop. The lives of patients may end within days. Patients with kidney problems are the most affected. There are more than 5,000 patients who need dialysis several times a week.
The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Controversial intra-Afghan talks in Qatar is reaching its final days, but so far they have failed to even reduce the level of violence in Afghanistan. In the meantime, the U.S. is calling for the creation of interim government. Tamim Alami is in Kabul.
It's been almost 6 months since the first intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital Doha, but so far no viable agreement has been reached. The situation in Afghanistan has now become so complicated that the Afghan president is agreeing to hold an early election.
We stand ready to discuss holding free, fair, and inclusive elections under the auspices of the international community. We can also talk about the date of the elections and reach a conclusion.
Ashraf Ghani, however, strongly rejected a U.S. plan to form an interim government. The Afghan president said the only legitimate way to gain political power in Afghanistan is through elections.
Any institution can write a fiction on a piece of paper and suggest a solution for Afghanistan. These papers have been written in the past and will be written in the future. Our guarantee is our constitution.
President Ghani's comments came after calls for forming an interim government in Afghanistan increased in the past couple of months. This is why the U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad met some top prominent political leaders, tribal elders and other influential figures during his recent visit to Kabul. The meetings soon faced mixed reactions. Many here say the main agenda of Khalilzad is to convince the Afghan president to accept an interim government and hold another round of talks in Turkish capital Ankara.
This is clear that Khalilzad wants to put pressure on both the Afghan government and the Taliban to approve an interim government. President Ghani's reaction also means that he is not ready to accept whatever Washington wants.
While the Afghan government brands the establishment of any interim government as the death of democracy in Afghanistan, President Ghani's yes to an early election is considered as a green light for the Taliban to join a democratic process in order to gain power. Now, only time will tell whether or not the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the U.S. can make a comprehensive agreement or not. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
To another one of our headline stories, the two top Democrats in New York State Legislature urged Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign over sexual harassment allegations against him. The officials said the accusations against the governor by five women have undermined Cuomo's ability to lead. State's Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart Cousins, I believe, noted that Cuomo's governing style has created a toxic work environment. Stewart Cousins stressed that the governor's office also underreported the coronavirus death toll among nursing home residents. Earlier, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called the allegations against Cuomo deeply troubling and said he backed the ongoing investigation. Five women, including former aides, have come forward recently to say Cuomo had sexually harassed them or made inappropriate remarks, I should say. On that story, I'm going to bring in Mr. Jim Cavanaugh. He's the founder of thepolemicist.net, who joins us via Skype out of New York City. Sir, it's good to have you with us. What would you imagine would be the reason for this? And, of course, you know, I'd like to ask you about the timing of this whole thing.
Yeah, you know, Cuomo was the hero of the Democratic Party last year, and he was projected as the anti-Trump and the guy who should be president, et cetera. Now his own party is turning against him. You know, these are the highest ranking Democratic officials in New York State, elected Democratic officials. And, it's one of these things that you see this kind of tsunami developing of allegations coming out one by one, and then there's four or five. And so it's a strange thing. Now, there are other things going on with Cuomo that politically and you know, in terms of what's going on in the country are more substantial, I think. That is, he's had problems with his allegations about his nursing home practices. Mm-hmm. You know, he gave liability to nursing home executives who had, their nursing home lobby had contributed $1 million to his campaign. And for that, they got liability for any COVID damages, any mistreatment of patients related to COVID. And then there was this whole, that then became an issue of whether the deaths from COVID in nursing homes were deliberately undercounted and they were manipulated. So that's a real substantive thing. The Albany newspaper actually called for him to resign over that before these sexual allegations came up. So you have a timing here that's, you know, there's a, you get this sense in the United States that when they want to come out with these allegations against people, they come out with these allegations against people. Now, I don't know why the Democratic Party would be doing it, but it is a very, there's hardly any defense against it. You know, I don't want to defend Cuomo. I actually knew a woman who was a hostess in a restaurant, and she told me a couple of months ago that Cuomo would come in with Trump and sit at Trump's table all the time, and he was a real jerk. I don't doubt that he had some kind of inappropriate behavior, although there's no allegation about any sexual activity. It's all talk and et cetera. But it seems like, you know, they're out to get him, and they probably will. It's going to be hard for him to function, even if he wanted to fight. He does want to fight against this, and, you know, he has the right to fight against it if he wants. But it's hard for him to function when even the top officials of his own party are against him and are constantly, there's this drumbeat of allegations and investigations that will make it difficult for him to function as governor.
Yeah. Mr. Cavanaugh, who do you think is going to benefit from this, just considering the fact that if you say it's going to be hard for him to function or it's going to be hard for him to fight, who's going to be benefiting from this?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I can't say cui bono. You know, I point to someone and say, I see the point that person or that agent or that group of people is going to benefit from it. You know, the Democratic Party in New York's, I don't think it's going to benefit from it in any way. I don't think it's any outstanding political figure waiting in the wings who's been kind of waiting to come into this. So I don't know, you know, unless they really want to, they're afraid of more information coming out about the nursing home scandal and about Cuomo's potential corruption in relation to taking campaign contributions, closing hospitals, pushing people into nursing homes, giving the nursing homes liability from any further damages to that. And the Democratic Party is trying to protect itself from more information about that coming out while he's governor. But it's a very good question. I don't see an individual, you know, who's going to benefit from this immediately in some kind of direct way.
Mm-hmm. Jim Kavanaugh, founder of the polemicist.net website out of New York. I really appreciate your comments, sir. People have held a rally in the U.S. city of Minneapolis a day before the trial proceeding for the death of African-American George Floyd is set to begin. Black Lives Matter activists demanded justice for the man who died at the hands of a white police officer in May of 2020. A rally came a day before jury selection is scheduled for the trial of former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin. Cell phone footage showed Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for just shy of 9 minutes. He is now facing second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Three other officers at the scene are also facing trial. The death of Floyd sparked a flurry of protests against racial injustice and prompted calls for police reform in the U.S. Colin Campbell joined us earlier with more on the trial of the white police officer responsible for the killing of George Floyd.
They have to come up with 12 jurors and four alternative jurors, and what they're looking at are people who would be more impartial. The person who is being prosecuted is supposed to be tried in front of a group of impartial jury members. But that's going to be the challenge here, as the prosecution and the defense look to weed out people who have been influenced by some of the news coverage regarding George Floyd. Now, if we remember, everybody, almost everyone knows about this case. So that's going to be the biggest challenge right now. And the judge also can use his discretion to weed out people and jurors who he thinks could be tainted by coverage or other types of experiences. But I think that we are going to see and hear more vociferous voices coming from the community to push for police reforms and a change in policy.
Thousands have marched in Haiti to demand an end to the incumbent president's tenure amid a political turmoil in the country. Protesters burned barricades in the streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince. A volatile Caribbean nation has witnessed a bitter dispute over when the president's term is supposed to end. President Jovenel Moïse won power in a disputed vote in 2015. He also won a rerun of the presidential election in 2016. Haiti's opposition claims that he should step down as his five-year term in office expired in February, but Moïse says he took power in February of 2017 and his term is therefore yet not finished. He has pledged to step down next year. Tensions flared recently after Moïse alleged there was an attempt to overthrow the government and dozens of people were arrested. Now, at least 15 people have been killed in a series of large explosions at a military base in the city of Bata in Equatorial Guinea. President Teodoro Obiang says some 500 people were also injured in the incident. In a statement on national television, Obiang stressed that the blasts were caused by negligence related to the use of dynamite at the base. Local media have called on people to donate blood while noting that hospitals in the region were overwhelmed. The blast comes as Equatorial Guinea, an oil producer, suffering a double economic shock because of COVID-19 pandemic and a drop in the price of crude, which provides around three-quarters of state revenue. And finally, Ivory Coast's ruling party and the main opposition have both claimed victory in the country's legislative elections, with the complete results still to be announced. A senior member of the ruling party said they have reached or achieved their goal of securing around 60% of the seats, but the top opposition party said it has grabbed over 50% of the seats. The opposition party also alleged that preliminary results were, quote, strewn with fraud, tampering, and manipulation. Observers estimate that as turnout to be only 20%, citing fear of violence in the former French colony. The parliamentary vote is a key test of stability 4 months after violence over the presidential vote. Clashes claimed around 90 lives in the West African nation.
A diverse range of programs. youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States has been at war for nearly every year of its existence as an independent nation, fighting in 227 years of its 244-year history. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. and Allies Drop 46 Bombs Per Day for 20 Years. New Code Pink Research Reveals. Here's the details. The United States and its allies have dropped at least 326,000 bombs and missiles on countries in the West Asia-North Africa region since 2001. That is the conclusion of new research by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis of anti-war group Code Pink. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen are the countries that have felt the worst of the violence. But Lebanon, Libya, Pakistan, Palestine, and Somalia have also been targeted. The total amounts to an average of 46 bombs dropped per day over the last 20 years. Code Pink's numbers are based primarily on official U.S. military releases as well as data from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the Yemen Data Project, and the New America Foundation. As striking as the figure of 326,000 is, it is an underestimate, as the Trump administration ceased publishing figures of its bombing campaigns in 2020, meaning there is no data for Iraq, Syria, or Afghanistan for either of the previous 2 years. Also not counted are bombs or missiles used in helicopter strikes, AC-130 gunships attacks, strafe-finding guns from U.S. bombers, or any other counterinsurgency or counterterrorism operations in other parts of the world. U.S. President Joe Biden recently gave the order to attack Iraq anti-terror forces in Syria, dropping 1.75 tons of bombs on a border village and killing 22 people, something that brought cheers from Washington insiders and corporate media pundits alike. The move was reportedly in response to strikes on U.S. military bases in Iraq, bases that last year the Iraqi parliament unanimously demanded be closed. Recently, anonymous administration officials claimed that Biden called off a second serious strike after being warned that women and children were in the area. Though no evidence was offered and the officials refused to go on record, corporate media diligently parroted the State Department line, allowing the new administration to simultaneously present itself as getting tough on its enemies and as a champion of human rights. The United States has been at war for nearly every year of its existence as an independent nation, fighting in 227 years of its 244-year history. While both Barack Obama and Donald Trump offered up anti-war rhetoric, when they were on the campaign trail, both moved steadfastly away from that position once in office. By 2016, Obama was bombing seven countries simultaneously and had earned the moniker Drone King. Trump, meanwhile, escalated the war in Yemen and even carried out the targeted assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani while he was in Iraq for regional peace talks. The 45th president also authorized the use of mother of all bombs, a 21,000-pound, that is about 9,500-kilogram explosive dropped on Afghanistan's Nangarhar province in April 2017. Many of the Biden administration's early moves signal that there will be more continuation of than rupture with previous U.S. foreign policy in the West Asia region. While Biden had pledged to end U.S. role in Yemen, the U.S. State Department qualifying language makes it clear that the U.S. is merely returning to Obama's position on the conflict. Biden promised only to end support for offensive Saudi campaigns and limit relevant arms sales. Yet his administration immediately began emphasizing its commitment to help Riyadh defend itself from aggression. The U.S. envoy Timothy Leatherking even went so far to praise the Saudi Arabia regime for its generous support over the decades for the people of Yemen. On the Zionist regime, Biden has fully supported Trump's decision to move the American embassy to Al-Quds, a controversial move effectively approving the Zionist regime occupation of Palestine. Today, Vice President Kamala Harris had a meeting with the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in which she reaffirmed the White House's unwavering commitment to the Zionist regime and its security. Meanwhile, Biden has framed Syria attack as a message to Iran. Despite its spending almost as much as every other country combined on defense, the impact of war is largely unfelt in the United States. As media Benjamin and Davis write, the American public and the world are left almost completely in the dark about the death and destruction our country's leaders keep wreaking in our name. With studies such as this one, Code Pink hopes to change that fact.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and how about reflecting upon a maxim bequeathed to us for our guidance by the command of the faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Seeking God's forgiveness along with the insistence on committing the sin from which you seek forgiveness are additional sins.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر. خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And the expert I have to discuss this, as usual, on the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, is Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, good friend, academic scholar, and Islamic scholar as well. A very warm welcome to you, sir. Salam and hello.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we are looking at the Imam's will.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the analysis, if you like, the thinking behind why is it so essential that we Muslims must be united.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's look at what he said in this quote. Unfortunately, in the hands of conniving enemies and ignorant friends, the Holy Quran, this divine book that is empowered to decide man's destiny, has found no place anywhere except in graveyards and at gatherings of the dead, for the dead, although technically also of the dead.
Of the dead, of course, yes.
The instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind. The instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind.
Yes. And all mankind.
Listen, Imam is, you know, it's his last will. So he's being hardcore.
He's very hardcore.
He's not even...
And because when he says all mankind, of course the Quran is for all humanity, for all time.
Right.
Whether we are believers or not is immaterial.
Right. The instrument that was to unite the Muslims and all mankind and serve as the scripture for their lives and salvation has turned into an instrument of division and dispute among men, or it has left the arena entirely. We all witness that whoever spoke of Islamic rule or of politics, which is the major role of Islam and its prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or of the Quran and the Islamic traditions, was regarded as one who had committed a grave sin. The term Ahund Siyasi, political clergy, came to denote a profound obscurantist.
Right.
These circumstances still exist. In recent years, major satanic powers have, through their puppet regimes, undertaken to reprint and publish the Holy Quran, distorting sacred verses to serve their devilish ends. Such Qurans are published with attractive calligraphy and binding and are distributed everywhere with the aim of eventually removing the holy book from all scenes. We all remember the Quran that Muhammad Reza Khan Pahlavi had printed. He succeeded in deceiving some people, including a few Muslim ahunds or preachers who, unaware of the aims of Islam, praised him for it. We note that each year, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, at that time it was King Fahd in Saudi Arabia, spends a good deal of wealth of the people in printing the Holy Quran and considerable publicity and propaganda material in support of the anti-Quranic ideas, propagating the baseless and superstitious cult of
Wahhabism.
Fahd abuses the Quran, urges negligent people and nations to side with the superpowers. He uses noble Islam and the Holy Book to destroy both. And let there be no doubt that, I'm saying this now, this is not a quote, that it is exactly the same way today.
Exactly.
With Abdullah.
With Abdullah and Prince Bandar.
And whoever it is that's going to rule the Al-Saud, because Al-Saud look at Islam as an instrument to maintain their
own
rule.
Power.
They don't really care about Islam.
No, they don't, because they burn the Qurans as well.
Right. We are proud, this is Imam, and I love this part, we are proud, and our dedicated nation is proud that we adhere to the faith in which the Holy Quran speaks of the unity.
The unity, yes.
The unity of all Muslims and the oneness of mankind.
Oneness of mankind.
Because it's not just about the unity of Muslims, it's the oneness of
all mankind.
We are proud that our faith has retrieved the Quran from the cemeteries and has saved this holy book as man's prescription for freedom from all physical, mental, and intellectual bonds that push him deeper into slavery and nothingness.
Into non-existence.
We are proud to be followers of a religion whose founder has been designated by divine commandment, and in which Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam, this servant of God, free of all bonds and shackles of servitude and serfdom, has been appointed to deliver mankind from all the chains of slavery and enslavement. We are honored that the book Nahjul Balagha, which is next to the Quran, is man's great manuscript for salvation, moral and material existence, and the greatest instrument for just rule and government, and has our infallible Imam Ali as its author. Well, you know, what can I say? We see these things. There's other things he says here, which I think is very nice. And I'm reading this in the beginning, and then we're going to talk a little bit more, because I think, you know, his own words really
say it all.
Right. Our nation, indeed all Islamic nations, as well as the meek and oppressed, are pleased to see that their enemies, who are the enemies of Almighty God, of Islam and of the Holy Quran, are indeed savages. Who do not desist from committing any criminal acts to promote their mean purposes, and who are unable to tell a friend from a foe in achieving treacherous goals. I think this would
goes down. Reflects Syria very well
with what's going on in Syria.
Syria, very well.
Okay, now
savages.
Let's listen to the sentence. Yeah. This sentence that's going to come.
And digest that.
And let's just ponder on it.
The
USA is the foremost enemy of Islam. Period.
What's new?
It is a terrorist state by nature.
Ah, and they declared a war on terror, didn't they?
It is a terrorist state by nature that has set fire to everything, everywhere, and its allies. The internet and its allies. Everything, everywhere, and its allies.
Allies as well.
No, no. And its ally, international Zionism, stop short of any crime.
Yes, the Zionist regime.
And its ally, international Zionism, does not stop short of any crime to achieve its base and greedy desires. Crimes that the tongue and the pen are ashamed to utter and write.
True.
The insane idea of a greater Israel urges them to commit any shameful act. The Islamic nations and the mustazafin, the weak and oppressed peoples of the world, are pleased to have Hussein of Jordan, a professional itinerant criminal, Hassan of Morocco, and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, fellows of Israel, as their enemies. The people are proud to have them as their enemies. These are criminals with Israel. These are co-criminals with Israel and commit any act of treason against their own nations to serve the USA. We cheer to have Saddam the Afalaki as an enemy, whom friend and foe know to be a criminal, a violator of human rights and international laws, and whose betrayal of the people of Iraq and of the Persian Gulf Emirates has been no less than his betrayal of our country and people. We and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be objects of criminal accusations by the superpowers through their international mass media under their control.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I mean, think about this. This is
right at the beginning. Well, you know,
I mean, think about all these people who, these Muslims who so desperately try to.
Yeah.
Oh, please love us. Yes. Oh, please, we're good.
We are good. We are nice.
Right.
We're peaceful.
He's saying we're proud.
Yeah.
We're delighted.
Yeah.
To be objects.
Objects.
Of criminal accusations.
Exactly, because it keeps us on the right path.
Well, I mean, I think it just you have to understand Islam.
Yes, this is it.
Right.
This is what we're talking about.
What can be a better source of pride, this is him speaking. What can be a better source of pride than the fact that the USA, with all its military might, its boastfulness, its claims, its mass media, and its allies among puppet regimes, has been so dumbfounded and disgraced in its dealings with the dauntless Iranian nation and the land of His Holiness Bariatullah.
Wonderful.
That it does not know which way to turn and who to turn to. This is not the work of anyone. This is not the work of anyone or anything except divine assistance.
Divine assistance.
That has awakened nations. Islamic awakening?
Islamic awakening.
Particularly the Iranian Muslim nation, and has guided it from darkness into light, the light of Islam. And this is the final paragraph that I'm going to read. I now take this opportunity to advise the oppressed and noble nations, including our own, to stay firmly on this divine straight path that leads neither to the atheistic, mulhid, God-denying East, nor to the oppressive, idolatrous West, but to the path which Almighty God has decreed for us.
Exactly.
I further advise not to be negligent even for a single moment in being grateful for this blessing. Let no polluted hand of a superpower or its agents, whether domestic or foreign, affect your determination and will. Know that the angrier the Eastern or Western satanic powers get, the more proof it is for your divine support. And God shall reward and punish the deserving ones in the best fashion, in this and in the other worlds.
Oh,
and then he quotes, he quotes an ayah from Surah Mu'minin. Verse 88, truly He is the Lord of all blessing, and in His hand lies the dominion over all things.
Well, that, in a nutshell, says everything about the greatness of the Imam in terms of the fact of the understanding of Islam, because this has been a big, big problem for many centuries. And he's given us the path, if you like, the road to salvation, and telling us that in the circumstances we are now, and we are talking about 25 years on since he said those words, and we see the situation for what it is, and everything about it still is fresh. It's still it's become crystal clear now. I mean, at that time when he was seeing those things, that wasn't clear. But now we see them, the savages for what they are, who is the real enemy of Islam. And for us, as he says, the greatest divine blessing for us is the fact that the more angrier they become with us, the better.
And, you know, I don't know. I think it really, you got to think about what he's saying. He's saying that, you know, you have to understand the nature of who they are.
Exactly.
We were
talking about that,
right,
in another program, that we must know our enemy.
Right. And he's talking about their terrorist state by nature.
Yeah, of course.
So
where are these human rights and all these other things they
then
talk about?
Then he's talking about the fact that, you know, we are delighted and it's a source of pride that they accuse us
Of criminal.
And they call us names.
They call us
this
names.
This shows that
Islamophobia in Europe and whatever else you call it.
And he says the angrier that they get, and he's talking both Eastern and Western satanic powers, as he puts it.
Sure.
The more proof it is for your divine support. And this is something, you know, this is a higher...
This is Quranic, you know, this is the Quranic
and
thinking.
And so this is the point we're trying to make with the listeners, and of course, in the first instance with ourselves.
Ourselves, yes.
You know, don't look at the minimum level of Islam.
Look at the
maximum
look
level.
Look at the maximum, look at the ultimate.
Look at that hardcore level of it.
Well,
and say, oh, I don't know. Well, no, you can do it.
Yes.
You know.
It's not difficult because the prophets themselves are our examples.
Right. So the point is that
peace be upon
obviously you. They're going to try to make you regret having gone this path.
Yes, they do, don't they?
Okay, shaitan, that's shaitan's job.
That's shaitan. He wants to make heaven look like hell.
Exactly.
And make
exactly
hell look like heaven.
Exactly. And so the point is that, you know, I don't think we should be so worried that they call us names or terrorists or whatever, you guys are this or that. I mean, reality, everybody's seeing this now. Maybe at that time...
At that time, it wasn't clear.
Right. At that time, they were maybe able to manipulate matters more.
Sure, sure.
You know, again, the example of Syria is a very good one.
Very good. The savages are there.
Right. I mean, it's very clear who's being barbaric there.
Barbaric there, yes.
It's the Americans and the Israelis and the Saudis.
Cohorts with the Wahhabis.
Right.
Yes.
When, of course, the, you know, poodles from Europe, you know, going along.
Yeah.
And the ones who are actually fighting for unity, who are fighting to maintain, you know, peace and
stability
and civilization. Right? Because remember, barbarism is always as opposed to the civilized, right?
Of
you have civilized and you have barbarians.
Barbarians. That's still true since Roman days.
So I think it's safe to say that, you know,
Iran is at the forefront of civilization.
Of civilization in this matter.
Exactly. And this is what's eating away at them at the moment because...
Because we're not... We're supposed to be...
Because I'm only going to quote from, you know, their own experts. Even, you know, Professor Neil Ferguson, who's also an Oxford economist from Oxford.
Scottish.
He's not Scottish. Ferguson. He is Scottish, I beg your pardon. Sorry, Mr. Ferguson. Anyway... He says, in his own words, that you know, the West is in decline because of its paganism and its hedonism and the fact that it is corrupt beyond belief. And because of that, their decline is such that they have gone into the depths of barbarism, but they don't realize it until now, 25 years on, as we were talking about the occupation movement, the Occupy movement. We were looking at other protests elsewhere throughout Europe. Of course, the Islamic awakening is on the one hand. But when we put all that together, we see the truth ringing out of the Imam's words. That's exactly the situation that we've got now. That people have now realized that, wait a minute, these people who were professing civilization and human rights and all the rest of it are in cahoots with liberators, head choppers, who, you know, I mean, we saw that on the screens, you know, Christian priests in Syria with their heads being hacked off with a saw. And they think that's okay. You tell me what the war on terror is all about.
Right. And I think the point that he's, Imam Khomeini is talking here too. He's speaking to Muslims.
He's speaking to Muslims.
He's saying to them, I mean, he says, obviously he's speaking to more than Muslims, but his main audience or the main people who are supposed to understand this are the Muslims. So it's, I think we have a problem in the Muslim world is that we don't really go to the furthest extent that the Quran wants us.
Exactly. And the other
we're always trying to, like, you know, kind of make it sweeter and nicer and let's have a whole big spoon of sugar that so the medicine goes down, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But
that's not the point. The point is that, you know, it's not about in your heart. And this is a different issue than trying to, you know, deal diplomatically with your enemy or with people. That,
no, that's not what we're talking about.
You know, it doesn't mean that you go out and you are rude. But in your heart, okay, don't. You shouldn't care what they say about
exactly. you. Because there is a Quranic ayat I was about to quote that the believers, the mu'mineen, are hard against the unbelievers but compassionate amongst themselves.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I'm really impressed by what he's saying here when we and the oppressed peoples of the world are delighted to be the objects of criminal accusations.
Yes.
By the superpowers through their international mass media.
In a sense, I'm getting that Islamophobia thing, aren't we?
He's like, this, you know, yeah, I mean, we're quite happy
that you're
doing
this.
And unfortunately, I see a lot of Muslims, they're like, oh,
no,
they're...
No, yeah.
yeah, don't, that's not good, whatever.
I don't want to say this, and I don't want to quote that. No, this is the point. You know, I was going to say, I saw on the television this wonderful image where you see Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, along with a good friend, Desmond Tutu.
Yeah.
The Archbishop with a huge cross. I mean, I love Desmond Tutu. I mean, he really knows how to decorate. So, but he's got the huge cross right in front. And what's he doing? He's doing pilgrimage. He's doing ziyara, as we say. Oh, Imam Khomeini. Desmond Tutu.
That's
you see,
very good.
That's the crux of what we're talking about. You see, I tell you, I used to have these debates with non-Muslims in my office when I used to work as an engineer. And when I used to say the nitty-gritty, which I grasped from the Holy Imam, that, look, this is the reality of things, you know. I mean, you may not know this now, but you'll realize this later.
Right.
And they didn't like what I had to say. It doesn't go down well. I used to see the colors change in the face, you know.
Right.
You, 1 minute red, next minute white, you know.
Right.
But maybe that's just the way Anglo-Saxons look. I don't know.
Right.
But
anyway, or blue,
as it happens to be in Scotland.
As Billy Connolly
said.
But
at the end of the day, you know what they said? They said, you know, you're right to stick to what you know. It's right to stick to principle. And that's the thing. This is what we're talking about here. That if we understand the reality of what we believe, we stick to principle,
right,
things will come our way. They'll realize that we really stand for something that's important, something that's truth. Otherwise...
I mean, I think it just goes back to, I mean, it goes back to what we've been talking about
in
different programs, which is, do you believe the Quran
or not? Exactly.
Okay. I mean, like you said, you know, people reciting it parrot-wise and...
Singers of the Quran.
That's, you know, we don't want that.
We don't.
We want somebody, and again, this is first addressed to ourselves... who, when they read about a promise, a divine promise in the Quran,
they believe it. Yes, because Allah said it. I believe Allah.
Okay, this is the problem. This is the problem. We want to believe, or we, you know, it makes us feel emotionally good when we hear this.
Mm.
But then when we're faced with these issues.
Issues, yes.
On a real
reality basis, right. Yes.
Whether it's as an individual or whether it's
as a
government or as a government official.
Yes, as a government.
And then we think to ourselves, well, how is it that God could really...
Mm.
You know, the Americans, with all their power, they can do this and that.
That, yes.
I mean, I'm very upset because our dear foreign minister said something he shouldn't have said.
Mm.
And, you know, and he did apologize afterwards.
Did he?
Yes.
Mm.
Well,
hadn't heard this.
He had to. He basically said that, you know, what are you talking about? They can destroy the Americans can destroy our, you know, anti-air
system, defense system.
With one bomb.
Mm.
And, you know, this, I think, shows a poverty of understanding.
It does.
Of what's going on. Because remember, at the time of the war.
Mm-hmm. And at the time when these, well, I mean, I know this is the will. But I just like to go back to the desert of...
Right, exactly. I mean, you know...
Desert of Tabas.
Right.
Please remember that one.
The point is that...
Where the Quranic verse of Surah Fil was recited, and I remember that it went through every mosque all over the world, that what happened in the desert of Tabas was like Surah Fil. End of story.
Right. And my point is this.
Yes.
Whether you know Surah Fil or you don't...
Don't, yes.
Okay,
yeah, sure.
Or whether you're able to...
Sorry, I meant the chapter of the elephant.
Right, exactly. And I'm simply saying that, you know, you have to understand that there is two schools. One is relying on divine assistance.
Exactly. Solely.
Right? And the other school is relying on other than that.
Well,
whatever that other thing is. Whether
yes.
Whether it's your own, you know, thinking that you yourself can do things.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know... whoever is going to help you, this nation, that nation.
Well, this is where I love that in the Quran, when I read that.
And these are the only two options.
Yes.
As a Muslim,
uh-huh.
right, this is my point. As
yes.
a Muslim, you have to believe in divine assistance. Otherwise, you don't really understand what you're doing.
Exactly, because what I was going to say was, and this is what you see in the Quran over and over again, Allah says, do you believe me when I make my promise to you that I will reward you both in this world and in the hereafter? Or have you decided in your heart of heart that you have other gods beside me.
Right. So the point is, it's not even about rational versus irrational, because they always come back and they say, well, you got to look at things rationally.
Rationally, yes.
This is the way the world is.
Yes, practically. Yes.
And the point is really this. Okay, if somebody from the beginning doesn't believe in God, yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Very rational.
Very rational.
You look at the material facts, so to speak, as they say, empirical analysis.
Yes.
And done.
Yes, you're thinking of your pocket and your stomach.
Now, the interesting thing is that empirical evidence proves that even relying on empirical evidence is not always reliable.
No, because we've got crises all over the place.
It's that thing you were talking about, which is you as an engineer, you do simulations where, hey, suddenly...
Thank you. Thank
right?
you.
I think
Why did you bring
I think
that back
I think
to me?
I think it's called Black Swan.
Yes.
It's called the Black Swan... In economics, they call it Black Swan.
It's a Black Swan, right?
Which is that, you know, an event that you... There was no way of predicting.
No way of predicting.
Just like, you know, it's very rare to have a Black Swan.
Oh, and it's, you know, very rare to have a 500-mile-an-hour wind, but you may get it and your bridge disappears.
Right. Yes. So the point is that even if you just... You know, there's a limit.
Yes,
doesn't mean
limit.
You shouldn't do empirical
yes.
analysis. Nobody's
yes,
against nobody's
yes.
against empirical
no,
analysis.
No,
nobody's
no.
against science.
No.
Right?
We invented it, actually.
Yeah, and remember, we bring down the drones.
We bring
right?
down the
with
drones.
Science.
Yes, with science.
All right?
Yes, thank you.
The point is that a step before that, or if you want to put it that way, this is happening within a larger context, which is the will of God.
Exactly.
Okay? So, at some point, you have to, with yourself, in your own heart, decide which one it is.
And this is what was the greatness of the Imam, wasn't it? May God bless his soul, Imam Khomeini, that he was completely and utterly devoted to Allah. And that's what's reflecting
yeah, I mean,
in his
complete,
verse.
Complete tawakkul.
He's saying, look, forget about all this. This is just an illusion. This you're deluding yourself by
yeah,
looking at
and
this.
It's a problem because you end up doing things that you shouldn't
should
have done.
Should not do. Because you'll be mushrik. You'll become...
You'll do things that will... won't be in your benefit.
No.
I'm talking about personal benefit.
Personal benefit even, yes.
Okay? Don't rely on these talwut.
No.
Okay? If they're saying things about you,
okay,
who
fine.
Cares?
Who cares?
You know, like Supreme Leader says, don't let their smile or their
frowns
deceive you.
Deceive you.
So what? They're smiling? They're frowning?
But I love the fact that the Rahbar, the Supreme Leader, did say that it's nice to have the experience.
He says, this too will be an experience.
This too.
Okay.
Right.
So, I think...
Yes, just to round off this particular session.
I think
those things
that we read, one,
yes.
It was an issue of unity.
Unity, yes.
And how
Number
it is
one.
Through the Saudis and through the Wahhabis and through the distortions of Islam.
Islam.
And through, you know, using people who appear to be Islamic.
Yes. To divide people.
To divide
the
and
Ummah.
To destroy Islam.
Islam, yes. Because the Holy Quran says that. Hold firm onto the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This unity, this is our power.
So let's not be fooled by anybody
fooled, yes.
in Saudi Arabia and all these guys.
No. And I hope
their goal is to get rid of Islam. And the only reason Ali Saud supports Islam is so that they can maintain their own family rule.
Yes.
And no other reason.
Yes.
There is no other reason.
No.
Okay? The other thing he talks about is the fact that, you know, we should be happy that you have certain... people who by nature are terrorists.
Yes.
I'm talking about governments.
Governments, yes, which is the U.S.
Right, and others.
Yes.
We should be proud of the fact that they are accusing us of things. Yes. Because that shows that, hey, we're doing it.
We're doing the right thing.
Right.
We're doing the right
You really
thing.
Don't want these guys to
no.
praise you.
No.
Once they start praising you, you gotta look at yourself.
Yeah, you've got to really reflect on yourself that something's right. gone wrong.
And going on this path, this Sirat al-Mustaqim,
yes.
which, you know, prevents you from being mulhid. Mulhid being a person who denies God altogether.
Yes, atheist, yes.
Antitheist.
Yes.
Actually, I think a good translation is antitheist.
Antitheist, yes.
Okay. And